Welcome to Dialogue, a true crime conversation. I am your host, Rebecca Sebastian. Welcome to episode 50, 5-0. Feels like a milestone, and I'm so excited we made it, and I can't believe it, but I'm happy you're here, and I think I want to get right into today's episode. I had the good fortune of speaking with a wonderful man from Phoenix, Arizona, named Benjamin Taylor. Benjamin is a civil rights attorney, and he has his own law firm with another partner. That's Taylor and Gomez, attorneys at law in Phoenix, Arizona. And Benjamin's area of expertise and where he focuses is civil rights cases. So I was excited to speak with him because he sees what's going on in our country today with the cases everybody's talking about, where there are deaths at the hands of law enforcement. And he talks about the connection to civil rights violations and which cases would be considered candidates to be pursued as civil rights violations and which wouldn't be. We talk generally just about the general culture in our country and the issues facing his clients who are dealing with their civil rights being violated. We also get through some definitions that I think are really helpful, clarification around defunding the police, governmental immunity, and hate crimes versus civil rights violations, you know, kind of all these terms that are being used frequently right now. And this is just a great episode to hear exactly what those mean, what we're talking about when we talk about those things. And also at the very end, Benjamin also gives us takeaways. These are things we can actually do because sometimes hearing and learning is overwhelming and can even be debilitating. So I asked Benjamin, but what could we do as lay people who aren't practicing or field experts? And he gives us some really good advice. So I do hope you will enjoy my time with Benjamin Taylor. Thank you also to Kirk Nurmi, a past guest who connected us. It was a great connection, and I'm so excited to share this conversation. As always, you can leave a rating and review on iTunes for Dialogue or wherever you listen to your podcasts. I am now hosting the show on the Anchor platform. I will have a link to that in my show notes, and you can actually support the show through small financial donations right through that link, as well as through my new merch store on bonfire.com. So I'll have those links in the show notes. I will also link to Taylor and Gomez, which is Benjamin's law firm, should you be in the Phoenix area in need of his services. But without further ado, let's kill the small talk and learn some really useful, pertinent, and relevant tools from Mr. Benjamin Taylor. Benjamin, thank you so much for being on Dialogue, a true crime conversation. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I'm excited. I'm really excited to talk to you. As you know, we connected through a past guest, Kirk Nurmi, who shared an office space with you in Arizona. And from what I understand, you're quite involved in civil rights cases in the law that you practice as a civil rights attorney, and you do other types of law as well, but that's really where I'm interested in speaking with you tonight about some different issues going on in our country. So I'm really thrilled you're here, and I appreciate you sharing your experiences and your insights.
Yes, no, I mean, thank you for having me, and I'm glad to talk and share my experiences in the practice of law and we know what we do. So
great. So maybe we could start there. How did you become a lawyer and why? Was it something you always knew you wanted to do? And what was your journey like to law school?
That's a very interesting question. I was an undergrad major at Arizona State University in Tempe, Arizona, which is a little bit of suburb of Phoenix, Arizona. So I was actually a finance major and majoring in finance. So during the time I was there, I was picturing myself being on Wall Street and, you know, selling stocks and bonds on Wall Street. So I had a couple of internships while at Arizona State University, and I realized that I wasn't really into the making money part of it. I mean, you can make good money, of course, on Wall Street, but I wanted more out of my life than doing that, so decided to go to law school. So I ended up going to University of Arizona for law school, which is in Tucson, Arizona. Majored and you know, graduated from with my Juris Doctor and came back up here and practiced law in Phoenix, Arizona. I've been practicing ever since.
Wow. So that was a major shift of the way you use your brain and the kind of information you're processing. That was a very major pivot.
Yes. No, I mean, finance is like, calculating numbers.
Yeah.
And looking at numbers and looking at stocks and bonds and everything. So I did that. I actually did an internship with the legislature, state legislature, being on their finance committee. I worked in the government, analyzing different bills and different financial bills that would affect people's taxes and everything. So, and it was good. I liked that. But, I think everybody feels that they want something else out of life.
Yeah.
They want something maybe more meaningful and have a more meaningful impact when their life is over. So that's why I figured the law, I can still do finance if I wanted to, but it allows me to represent clients and in the courtroom and everywhere. So.
Yeah, and there's so many areas and ways you can practice law that vary. So lots of possibilities there. And I want to hear all about what you're doing currently. But I want to ask you, since we have true crime listeners, is there a case that you remember kind of either from your youth or adolescence or adulthood, whenever, that really kind of stayed with you? And did that inform any part of you becoming a lawyer?
A little bit. I mean, so the O.J. Simpson case, that was during my high school years. And
same.
I think that was like one of the first major cases that was, televised throughout. So that was on every single day. That was the first case I remember growing up. So
yeah.
Growing up, seeing the attorney Johnny Cochran in court doing, representing O.J. Simpson. I mean, love him or hate him. And then seeing Marsha Clark, you love or hate the prosecution, and Chris Darden, just watching them, and in the courtroom, Shapiro, and just seeing that every day on your television, you're just automatically ingrained in it, because that was what the story was about every single day. That was like one of our first major television broadcasts of a trial. So right there, it struck me and interested me. But then I went on to school but then I always thought about the law was always in the back of my mind of what it would be nice to be a lawyer.
Same exact for me. I was also in high school, and it totally dominated media and conversations for so long. I think so many of us have that moment, like we know exactly where we were when the verdict was read. It's pretty interesting how that's such an American milestone that we can all relate to, even in different parts of the country. So how did you decide where will my specialty be? What population do I want to serve? What was that journey like for you once you were practicing law?
So while in law school, I worked for the prosecutor's office. So that helped pay the bills in law school. And I prosecuted different felony crimes. And I mean, as an intern, and helped out before I was licensed to practice law. I did that. And once after law school, I wanted to be more on the client side and represent the client. So one of my first jobs out of law school was at the public defender's office here in Maricopa County in Phoenix, Arizona. So I defended people from misdemeanors all the way up to felonies as far as, murder cases, DUIs, assaults, you name it. I was thrown into the fire. And that's one thing about, the public defender's office. A lot of times the public defender's office gets a bad rap because a lot of attorneys have, a lot of cases. But you get your teeth wet because you get thrown into the fire at a very young age. And you get to have jury trials, which a lot of attorneys don't have under their resume or under their belt, because they've just never done a jury trial. So I was able to do jury trials in front of jurors and pick a jury and go from beginning to end on jury trials. So it was very nice to be able to do that at a young age.
Yeah, and coming from the prosecutor's office, did that feel like an advantage? Because you're like, okay, I kind of know what they're doing over there, and I know their strategy, and here's how I can adjust and, position me and my client.
Exactly, yeah. Both roles are very important in the justice system. And the prosecutor's office, I was able to, prosecute cases and help prosecute cases and help victims
right.
get justice who have been violated, either, burglarized or assaulted, or, throughout any crime that they've been a victim of. So that was very rewarding to see that. And when you have victims, call you or write you a letter saying thank you for your help. Then the shift was, you know, to the defense side, because I always wanted to have a hands-on client too and help clients. A lot of times people, you know, attorneys get a bad rap because they represent some really heinous people. But I always tell people, as an attorney, you might not agree exactly what the person did, but you agree in the Constitution, and you agree that everybody deserves a defense. And when you get to know your client, you realize that just the person who made a mistake, actually a good person, but they just made a mistake or did something stupid. So, but they all have a family just like everybody else, and they all, you know, want the best for themselves. But they just got into a situation where they couldn't get out of, and they did something, you know, stupid, unfortunately. So,
yeah, you know, the unifying theme I hear, the more people I interview from all different roles within our system. So I've interviewed cops and prosecutors, defense attorneys, and the comment, what you're saying is really seems to be what I hear repeatedly, which is they made a bad decision. And some have even said we're all kind of one bad decision away from being in the same spot. There's a lot of circumstances and environmental factors and all other things that maybe prevent us or protect us, is maybe even a better word, from being in that position. But I'm sure your work humanizes people in a way that, you know, it might be easy for spectators not to know or to see.
Exactly. People, all they see is, you know, Benjamin Taylor, he's on TV, he's representing this client, and this client did murder. And people sometimes equate the a client with the defense attorney or whatever client they're representing. And a lot of times, people don't understand the backstory, you know, what the person went through. And a lot of times they are good people who have families, just like, you know, they have children. They have, you know, they have moms and dads. I mean, they are people. They just, you know, unfortunately either got into drugs or got into a situation where they couldn't get out of, and they're into it. But I'm sure if you ask everybody who's in prison, that I mean, most of them would say, I wish they would have been able to think before that they committed that crime.
Ugh. It's so heartbreaking, and it's so hard when you think about these opposing sides of the courtroom. The prosecutor has a job. The defense attorney has a job. Both have to happen. They both have to do their job well and to the standards that are assigned to them. But we have this desire to see somebody win, and by win, I mean justice to prevail. And so it's like, what is justice? If it gets so complicated, I guess, for me, because I'm sure if I understood a lot of the background of some of your clients, I'd really feel for them. But should that supersede a victim's justice, right? So it's amazing work. And what I'm saying is it's an incredible job. And I don't know how I would function in it, but it's our system. And I guess sometimes it feels broken and like it doesn't work. But the other thing I hear from my guests is that overall, it really is working. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Do you think the way our system is designed works for most people?
I mean, we don't have a perfect system, of course, and there could be a lot of changes in it. But I think if you look across the world globally, we have probably one of the most, you know, progressive and elite systems versus, you know, having a king or a queen stone you because they don't agree, you know, what you did or politics wise. At least, I mean, there's a lot of things that need to be changed in our justice system. And one thing is jurors, making sure that you really do get a jury of your peers. A lot of times only certain people can serve based on how they can't, I mean, because you'd be able to stay in a jury for a whole week. So if you don't have the income to be able to, you know, stay there for the whole week, a lot of times you can't serve jury duty, you know, and or so that's a big thing. And sometimes minorities who have to work, especially in Arizona, they get kicked off or they can't be on the jury because they have to work. So sometimes you get a juror of kind of the same people who are older, retired, and people say jury of your peers, but those are the people who can serve because they're retired. They can sit on the jury.
Right.
But then if you have similar minds, it's not really a diverse group of people who are judging, you know. So sometimes people get judged because of stereotypes, the way they look. So it's not the fair system, but I wish there was a way to make sure that everybody does get a jury of their peers.
Yeah, I have to be honest. I think the jury system, is one of the most terrifying parts of our system. Like, I think if I were in a position where I needed a trial, I would ask for a bench trial. I feel like I trust one judge so much more than 12 random people. I don't know. I guess that's risky because it doesn't happen a lot. But when I do see people make that choice, I'm like, yep, that's what I would do. It feels so scary to me to put my fate in 12 people's hands.
Exactly. Yeah. 12 strangers that you never met, never know. And they're judging you by the way you speak, by the way you look. And that's the thing. If you ask most attorneys, we win cases that we think we would lose, and we lose cases that we think we should have won. And you go back and talk to the jury, and the jurors tell you some interesting things about your case. And you're like, because the client, looked at me too long, or
oh my gosh,
some weird things, because they wouldn't stand up or something, they stated, unfortunately, sometimes jurors make up some odd things they shouldn't to either, help your client or hurt your client. So
right. The
juror selection portion, I would tell people, is the most important part of the trial, because these are the people who are going to, help your client or hurt your client in the day. If you're doing a criminal case, if you're doing a civil case, the juror is going to be the one to decide the case. You want to make sure the jurors like you, and hopefully they like your client.
So how do you advise your clients in this scenario? Are you usually trying to plead out and avoid getting them in front of a jury in a courtroom, or are you eager to go to court and have their day?
I mean, I've done a lot of jury trials. I've done, misdemeanor trials up to capital murder case trials, death penalty cases. And depending on the facts and the circumstance, if your client is looking at a lot of time in prison, and if you really think that your client could get convicted in front of a jury, that's when you do your best to negotiate a plea agreement for less time. So if your client is looking at 30 years if they go to trial, hopefully you can negotiate something 10 years or less. And so that's the best way. And then you have to have that talk with your client to make sure that your client understands everything. Because going to trial, like we mentioned earlier, you're having 12 strangers who don't know you. And the jury sometimes judge people based upon some information that's not even relevant. They shouldn't be doing that, but this is human nature.
Yeah, it's the human nature variable card. It's just too much of a wild card for me. And also, they don't know the law. And I know they're given instructions on what to hear and disregard that, what they said. But once a person has heard something, even if they're not supposed to factor it into their decision, how do you not hear it? How do you unhear something? It's just, I think we're just too, we're too human. We're too imperfect. It's, I don't know. I guess it's just what we have and we have to work with it. But I get very riled up about juries, as you can hear. Sorry.
Yeah, no. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah.
Guess what? Birdie is back. Today's episode is sponsored by Birdie, the modern personal safety alarm made by women for women. You don't have to listen to true crime podcasts for that long to know keeping yourself safe is really important. I chose Birdie because it works, it's easy, and honestly, I like how it looks and I don't mind it being on my keychain. I also love that the company was founded by two sisters who are also moms because they wanted to protect their daughters when they sent them off to college. They learned that 1 in 5 women in the United States is raped at some point in their life, and they wanted to do something about it. Speaking of mothers and daughters, I also got one for my teenage daughter who recently called me and asked if she could stay out just a bit later than we had previously agreed on. She laid out all her reasons, and she ended up saying something I really couldn't argue with. In fact, Annabelle is here today. What did you tell me, Annabelle?
Don't worry, I have my Birdie.
And I didn't worry, because Birdie is loud. It's a 130 decibel siren and has a flashing strobe light when activated. It won't go off unless you set it off, and me and Annabelle even practiced this, so now we feel confident that should we ever need to activate our Birdie, we can do it with no problem. So whether you're running, walking, or hiking by yourself, the Birdie is a great boost of confidence to have on you, and they donate a percentage of profits to organizations that support women's health, safety, and empowerment. Dialogue listeners can receive 10% off their purchase of Birdie by using the code DIEHARD. That's DIEHARD at checkout. Go to shesabirdie.com and use the code DIEHARD for 10% off today. Chirp loudly.
Okay, so currently you're working in civil rights cases. Now, would this be in a private capacity where people are hiring you because their rights have been violated, or are you still as a public defender with a focus on these cases?
Yeah, no. So I was the public defender's office for 5 years. I've been practicing law for a total of going on 15 years now. So
okay.
I've had my own private practice of Taylor and Gomez Law. I'm a partner there. We do personal injury, family law, criminal defense, and we do civil rights. And the way we got into civil rights was because, well, being a criminal defense attorney, a lot of my clients were telling me, you know, Mr. Benjamin Taylor, I'm getting beat up. And you look at some pictures and you're like, dang, you know, you are, you know, you've broken some bones, your face is all messed up. And we would start, you know, looking into it, like, how can we, you know, what can we do? So part of civil rights is suing police officers who have abused or shot police brutality, you know, that really hurt our clients. So that was how we got into transferring from criminal defense into civil rights. A lot of our clients were getting abused, and we had to look into it, investigate, and then we started filing lawsuits against police departments.
This is a huge conversation in our country right now, and to some it might feel new, like, why is this happening now and all of a sudden? But you know, this has been happening for a very, very long time. And how widespread is it in your community where you practice in Arizona? Are we talking, like, how many cases do you see where police brutality or an issue of a civil rights violation applies to your client's situation?
I mean, a lot of times. And the issue is, which people have been seeing in the news, is what you call governmental immunity. So these cases are hard for civil rights attorneys to represent because the officers get what you call governmental immunity. What that means mainly means is this. If an officer shoots your client and kills your client, right, whose word is there? It's only the officer's word. Your client is usually dead. So if there's no body camera, there's no other evidence to refute the officer's statement. So that means governmental immunity applies. When you go from the court, meaning myself and other civil rights attorneys, we have to show the judge that there could have been a different way this happened. How do you show the judge that? You can't, because nobody else was there unless there's some eyewitness that saw this. Right. So governmental immunity applies, and a lot of these civil rights cases get dismissed. So we get calls all the time from people who have, you know, been you know, brutalized, who say an officer, you know, hit me or shot me or, you know, down the chain. However, they're hard to prosecute unless you have an independent witness or a video, or else most attorneys are not going to take the case because we already know with the governmental immunity, a judge is going to kick the case out and dismiss the case.
Right. Okay. So that makes sense to me, and it's really unfortunate, but it makes sense. So what we're seeing right now in sort of the big ones that are circulating right now, so I'm thinking of George Floyd, of course, Breonna Taylor, and Ahmaud Arbery, where we have, well, I guess we don't have footage in Breonna's situation. We have audio, but there's video in Ahmaud Arbery's case and in George Floyd's. So, but I have heard this governmental immunity term tossed around. Now we also have charges, and there's been a lot of movement criminally in both of those cases. But can you talk about the addition of body cam footage and what we're seeing in these current cases? And your take on them, perhaps?
Oh, yeah. So there's been a movement right now. So there's no law that requires body cameras. It's just up to each police agency. So right here, if you're in Phoenix, if you're in Washington, D.C., Atlanta, New York, each police department has their own policies and procedures. So what we like to see is having a law that would require body cameras on each officer. And that would, what that would do is even, that would protect the officer. So if the officer was falsely accused, they would have a body camera, and that officer would be able to, you know, show the supervisor and the police chief, hey, look at the body camera. You know, I didn't do anything wrong. And vice versa, it would help the citizen. And if the officer did do something wrong, you could watch the body camera. So we But now what you're having is, you know, unfortunately, citizens are getting shot. I mean, the officer could be in the right, they could be in the wrong. But without the body camera, you don't have any evidence to, you know, proceed forward. So body camera is so crucial now. So it would be nice to have an executive order or each police agency throughout the nation require officers to wear body cameras. It would just make the justice system fair for everybody, fair for the officers and fair for the community who the officers serve.
I agree. So what is the resistance there? I would imagine it's partially financial. I'm sure tons of money are being, you know, it would have cost a lot of money. But do you think there's resistance because it's inherently accountability? Or what do you think, why do you think not everybody's adopting that practice?
I believe a lot of it is financial. I mean, body camera footage is expensive. You have companies that have to store a lot of the evidence. But I believe a person's right to freedom and making sure that the justice is fair, you can't put a price tag on that. So I think a lot of the hesitation is, I think some officers don't want to be heard or seen on body cameras. So they want their privacy. And, you know, however, I believe if you decide to become an officer, and they have tough jobs, and officers, I mean, a lot of the officers are good out there. I mean, most of them are good. But you have the bad apples, and they are, you know, they say, you know, spoiling the bunch. So I think if you're a good officer, you wear one, nothing's going to happen to you. But if you're a bad officer, I think the bad officers, they're doing something bad and sneaky, so they want to be caught on camera. And then if you do something really bad and you shoot somebody, then like you've been saying, with George Floyd and even in Atlanta, they are starting to, they, meaning the prosecutor's office, are starting to prosecute officers who violate the law, who shoot and kill people. That is not justified. So I think officers know that without the camera, you can't see it, right? But nowadays, as an officer, you would want to wear a camera to protect yourself just in case somebody wrongfully accuses you also.
Oh, man, it's so much. So what do you think is behind that? You said there's a few bad apples. Most cops are good. I tend to agree. But the way the conversation in our country is going right now, I'm thinking, am I mistaken about that? Are these departments built on systemically problematic racist policies that do unfairly target minorities and people of color? What do you think about that?
I think each officer, when you go to the police academy and continue being an officer, you need some, you know, systematic racism training. You know, you need some implicit bias training because, of course, racism and prejudice, I mean, people who grew up with that, it's in their system.
Yeah.
So you can't change it. But hopefully, if they get some training on that, how do you approach people of different cultures? How do you, you know, respect people's, you know, cultures? I think you might like eliminate racism, but maybe you can mitigate it so that way people can approach that. I think one big thing is police unions. And police unions protect bad officers, unfortunately. And when an officer does something wrong, the police unions are quick to jump in and protect the officer, which I understand, that's their job. However, police unions are very political. They give a lot of money to politicians, to the prosecutor's office, to the mayors, to the governors. So I think, you know, politics plays a lot in police and justice reform and body cameras. So if you have police unions who are giving a lot of money to different organizations, they're going to listen to what the police union says, unfortunately.
Very interesting. I haven't heard a lot about that in all this conversation. So it feels like without directly addressing it through a question of mine, we're talking about police reform. Some of the things you're bringing up are ways that we could maybe reform and establish better practices within departments, this trainings to racial sensitivity and bias, making sure everybody has a body cam, and then possibly maybe addressing the police unions, which sounds really hard, I would imagine. So would you agree that that's police reform? And does that align with defunding? Can you talk about defunding versus reform, or are they synonymous? I feel like there's a lot of confusion around that for me.
Yeah, so I understand some people want to defund the police. And that's, you know, a situation where I think people are saying just get rid of all these agencies. So I think everybody would agree that you still you know, several purpose. I mean, you can't, I mean, even myself, I would hate for somebody to break into my house and I can't call 911 and have a police officer come and do an investigation. So I think the terminology defund the police needs, though, I wish they would have used a different terminology, meaning maybe reform the police or criminal justice reform. And I think people are not saying we need to get rid of all police. I think people are saying that maybe instead of putting all these dollars into having police officers, why not use some of this money and to criminal justice reform or the money in education?
Yeah.
That way you're not putting all these money to police or prisons, and maybe you could start, you know, get the root of the problem in education. The people are educated, people have jobs, they probably have less crime and less situations like this. So that's what people are saying. But I wish they would have used a different word, because when people hear defund the police, people are like, what? You wanted to get rid of all police officers? And I don't think everybody wants to do that. I think they just want to allocate resources to somewhere else.
Yes, that was what I was hoping that interpretation meant. I think there is an extreme small group of people who actually want to dismantle and maybe abolish police forces completely. I don't think that's the majority of people, and I don't think that's the conversation we're actually, that's happening. So Minneapolis, for example, post George Floyd, they've already said they're taking steps towards defunding the police. And I think what that means is major, major reform. I don't think they've put out specifics. I think they're coming soon. But maybe we could just briefly talk about each of the cases I've briefly mentioned, because it feels like they're full of civil rights violations, and it's so complicated when it's at the hands of law enforcement. So in George Floyd's case, how would you look at that through your civil rights lens?
I mean, through your civil rights lens, that's going to be a huge lawsuit against the city of Minneapolis, because they definitely violated George Floyd's right, the civil rights, and they killed him. So what makes the civil rights case a civil rights case is when a government agency and a government actor, it could be a postal worker, it could be a police department, you know, any government agency, your government is doing something wrong, that's when it becomes a civil rights violation. And usually it happens when it's involving race, gender, religion, and people are discriminating against you or hurting you based upon those certain factors. So that's why in the George Floyd case, you have an officer with his knee on his neck for 9 minutes. And pretty much that we all witnessed a murder.
Yep.
And so in that instance, is one, you have a criminal case where the officers were prosecuted and they're going to be prosecuted. Either they'll take a plea to guilty or go to trial in front of a jury, and the jury will decide what their innocence or guilt is. But on the civil side, the civil rights side, that's when you sue the city of Minneapolis, you sue the police department, and using these cases, most of the time they fight back. The government fight back, and that's why it makes these cases so hard, and that's why a lot of attorneys don't practice civil rights, because the government fights back, and they fight back hard. But in this type of case, I would assume we will see a settlement in the near future, because I just don't see how the government's going to defend their actions and defend this cop's actions in this case. Clear as day, it's on video, and he's on his knee for 9 minutes without doing anything. So just killing him. So this is a clear civil rights violation.
Okay, so that act itself, it's clear cut to you. To the people who are talking about, but what about before the video? We don't know what happened before, and who are bringing up his past charges. From a purely legal perspective, is it completely irrelevant?
It's irrelevant. I mean, in the court of law, of course, if this were in front of a jury, jurors tend to listen and they hear that, okay, this person has prior criminal history. And a juror could be, you know, biased because they hear something like that. However, as a civil rights attorney, as attorneys, we say, okay, you can't judge a person on his past. You got to look at what happened today and what happened that day. So I don't care if he had no criminal history and he's an angel, or he had tons of criminal history. It doesn't matter. What matters is what happened that day. So even you have criminal history, you're allowed to go in and cash a check. You're allowed to go into a convenience store and buy something, you know, with a $20 bill, even if you're a criminal or, you know, have a criminal history or not. So he wasn't doing anything criminally wrong that day. And so that doesn't, you know, make a difference in the civil rights law. So if I'm in a court of law, I would say, judge, this shouldn't come up. It has nothing to do with what he was doing that day. And don't let that end in front of the jury. So the judge can dismiss any allegation of prior criminal history and let the jury decide based upon what happened that day on the video. So
okay.
So, and say, for example, yeah, and this is a thing that people need to understand too, is that no matter how bad a person could be acting prior, once they are in custody and handcuffed and they're not resisting, I mean, you are at the mercy of the police officers.
Yeah.
So they can't use excessive force. No matter what. I mean, I don't care. Unfortunately, you could have committed the most heinous crime ever.
Right.
Once you're in police custody, I mean, it's excessive force that they are beating you up or kicking you, and you're not doing anything.
I think it's what's so shocking to so many of us to have seen that he was already detained, and yes, he was big, and it might have taken more than one person, but what happened post-handcuffing should never have started.
Exactly. Once he's in handcuffs and he's not moving, officers need to abide by their law, too, and you can't use excessive force. You know? I mean, that's excessive force when you're being abusive.
Oh, man, I have so many questions running through my head. So you mentioned him purchasing something in the store. Now, there's, you know, it's purported that it's potentially allegedly, a counterfeit $20 bill, which to me, again, I don't think it should factor in at all, even if that was a fake $20 bill and if that is some kind of crime. And this kind of goes back to your work earlier as a public defender. I mean, to even pursue someone so aggressively over a $20 bill, let's just say maybe it was a fake one, doesn't that seem like an overreach for an arrest for that kind of offense?
Exactly, yeah. No, it's a very overreach for an arrest. A lot of times an officer might just cite you and give you a ticket and say your court date's in 2 weeks, so show up to court for this. And the sad part about the George Floyd case, after doing an investigation, they found out the $20 bill was not counterfeit. It was actually a legit
$20
bill.
Oh, man.
You know, it was proven that it was a real $20 bill. And they talked to the guy. I think the guy felt bad. He called the police on him. And they overreacted. And that's the thing that you see here. And you, people might see that what happened in Atlanta.
Yeah.
A lot of times people are called for some small, you know, I would say ridiculous things. So people call the cops and then it blows up. And this is George Floyd. That's what makes it so sad. He was called for allegedly trying to counterfeit a $20 bill, which it was a legit $20 bill. So he lost his life over $20.
Right. It's so flawed. It's so messed up. And I didn't hear that it actually was proven not to be, which again, doesn't change my opinion on what happened, but it certainly makes it even more tragic. And the Atlanta case you're talking about, I'm assuming is the one that happened just on Friday, Rashard Brooks. So he was sleeping in his car. Is that the case?
Exactly. Yeah, the Rashard Brooks case that just, you know, recently happened. I mean, that's a sad case, too, because he was sleeping in his car in the drive-thru.
Right.
So that's one of those things an officer should just say, go home, here's an Uber, let's tow your car, before it can escalate from sleeping in your car from a man who's unarmed, far as you know, he was unarmed, to losing his life. That's what people are talking about, criminal justice reform, systematic racism, because...
Yeah.
A lot of times people are feeling that this is happening a lot to the African-American community, and it's not really happening to other communities. So that's why, you know, when people are saying Black Lives Matter right now, that's what people are screaming. It's like, of course, people say all lives matter, and people agree all lives matter. But right now, the people who are getting shot and killed, it seems like, are Black people. So that's why going into the civil rights and going to, you know, the whole Black Lives Matter movement is more about saying, hey, you know, pay attention to what's going on in our country. I think people are now finally waking up, because now you do have body cameras. Now you do have cell phone videos. And this has been happening for years, decades, you know? I mean, this is not the first time
exactly.
in 2020 this is happening. This has been happening for centuries. However, now with technology, people are finally seeing and paying attention and seeing that, you know, case after case after case is happening, and people are now waking up and saying, dang, we need to do something about this, and this is not justice.
You couldn't have said it better. It's true. It's just being filmed now. And, you know, sadly, for those of us, myself very much included, whose privilege has completely protected me from having to really look at it and face it and see what it means, you know, to turn away right now would be such blatant. I mean, there's the kind of passive racism and sort of ignorance is bliss, right? But once you know, to not act and to not speak out and to not try to understand feels just so, so wrong. So I think we are at a really painful but critical moment in our country where people really are waking up to this. It's just tragic how many lives are we're losing in the process. But if there's any hope, I guess it's that.
Yeah, no, and that's just, I mean, George Floyd's death was tremendously sad, and I think everybody would agree. But I guess the one positive thing that's coming out, you're seeing people protesting. You're seeing all types of racists that are protesting. And that's the thing. When you watch the news and you see people who are protesting, it's a diverse crowd.
Yeah.
And laws are hopefully being changed. This past week, you know, you're seeing people trying to, you know, reform criminal justice reform, trying to get more body cameras, trying to get rid of governmental immunity. And people, I don't care if it's Republican or Democrat or what, you know, or what race or what nationality, what political affiliation it is, I'm seeing people are coming together to talk about this issue right now of civil rights and people getting shot by the police officers. So hopefully this momentum continues and we get some real change under the law. So that way laws are changed. I would hate to see all of this happening, all these protests happening, and then 5 months from now, somebody else gets shot and nothing has been changed.
Right. I mean, already with Breonna Taylor's case, the woman who was shot in her home, they've already, this was in Louisville, Kentucky, I'm sure you know, they've already enacted a no-knock, they're banning all no-knock warrants in that county. Now, that's not federal, but so that feels like that was pretty quick. I mean, that just took a few months from the time of her death, but those officers have not been charged yet either, I'm pretty sure, last time I checked.
And that's why that case is an interesting case because I mean the officers were, you know, going off of a warrant that the judge has given them. So, but they should have double checked to make sure that's the right house. So that's going to be interesting in the future to see if these officers will be charged or not. And that's where, you know, criminal justice reform comes in. The reason why some officers are charged and some officers are not is because the prosecutor, or in some cases the district attorney, does not prosecute officers. And it's really hard to prosecute the officer, and that's why it goes back to the political arena. A lot of times people don't want to prosecute officers because they're getting money from the police unit, the prosecutor is. And me, having worked in the prosecutor's office before, I see the politics. Most prosecutors, people may or may not know, that's an elected position. So you elect your your main prosecutor.
Yes.
So people don't, it's not a government appointment. It's not something that, you know, somebody, you know, applies for an interview. This is a position that people run for office. So depending on, you know, who your constituents are, that's going to determine if an officer gets prosecuted or not based upon a shooting, like in Breonna Taylor's case.
Just trying to sit with that for a minute to understand, because I've learned so much about the importance of the role of the district attorney in the criminal justice system. I think just from starting this podcast almost a year ago, I'm like, that is my big takeaway. That election is so much more important than I ever realized. But can you just break that down a little bit more for me, how it affects the decisions made in the arrests?
Yeah, sure. So your district attorney is the only person who can bring a case. That's the only person who can bring a case. Usually, or the attorney generals. And these are elected positions. So we as citizens, we vote to put this person in office.
Yes.
So that person who's the district attorney, if a case happens, they can say, yes, I will prosecute this, meaning that I'll charge that person for wrongdoing. Or they could turn a blind eye to it and say, no, I will not prosecute that case.
Right.
So in the civil rights movement and the civil rights doing these cases, a lot of the rights attorneys find it frustrating because we see our clients getting hurt, getting shot,
And prosecutors are either afraid or because of politics, they turn the blind eye and they won't prosecute because they're the only ones who have the power to prosecute. Unfortunately, the governor can't prosecute. Your mayor can't prosecute. Your city council person can't prosecute. Only that elected official. So that's why it's so important to get a person in there who is fair and who will do justice for the community, who will prosecute people who, you know, do wrong and don't prosecute people, you know, who haven't done wrong or who's able to get what you call a plea agreement, right? If a person who, first-time offender, who messes up and makes a mistake where I can't stealing a candy bar, hopefully your prosecutor is not trying to throw that person in jail for 8 months for stealing a candy bar. So yeah. It works both ways. But if a person does a crime and commits a murder, you want that prosecutor to have the guts to be able to go after the bad guys who do this. So that's why the prosecutors in the criminal justice system, they are the most important person, I would say, in the justice system, because that's where the case first begins.
They
decide whether or not to keep the prosecutor or not.
Sure. And it gets very complicated when the bad guy is one of their guys, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So yeah.
The prosecutors, they work with police officers every day.
Yeah.
And that's why it's very hard if you're working with the same person and you're having lunch with this person and you're having conversation over cases with this person. And then you want that person to turn around and prosecute or to turn around and prosecute the same person. It's going to be hard. So that's why in the civil rights movement, we want people to have independent prosecution. We want to, you know, it'd be nice to have a total independent prosecution when a civil rights violation like a police shooting happens. Bring in another agency who's totally independent to evaluate and investigate these cases. So that way, if the officer was right, they can be cleared. If the officer did wrong, they can be prosecuted. But when you have a prosecutor who's working with the same agency and police are judging themselves, it's going to be hard to prosecute this when this is the same person they're probably playing softball together with on the weekend.
Right. Sure. So. Sure. I think that's what we might be seeing in the Ahmaud Arbery case. If you've been following that one, also in Georgia, I think it's gone through a couple of DAs at this point, because now this wasn't a police officer who shot Ahmaud, but I think he was a former investigator for the state or the DA's office. So it is complicated, but are you familiar with that case and are you following that at all? Because I've heard that perhaps the FBI is coming in.
Yeah, and I've been following it. That's why you have to have an independent agency like the FBI or the Department of Justice to come in. In that case specifically, the two men who are accused of shooting Ahmaud Arbery, they traced it back. It looks like they are best friends with the county attorney, the district attorney, who's supposed to prosecute them.
Right.
And I guess they found that maybe there's some donations that were given to the district attorney and pitched to the district attorney. So how the prosecutor is going to prosecute their best friend? I mean, imagine you and I. I mean, are you going to be able to prosecute your brother, your sister, or your mom or dad? It'd be awfully hard to do that. And you have a conflict. So that's why you need independent agencies to come in. In this case, particular Aubrey's case, that is the sad part about it. You know, and the video was out there, the investigation was done, and they just sat on it. They didn't do anything because the prosecutor, you know, allegedly is like, "Hey, I'm not going to prosecute my friend." So nothing happened, and not until the video came out, and America saw this, and America's like, "What is going on here? This is ridiculous. These people should be prosecuted." That's when the political pressure came, and that's when, thank goodness, other people came in, and now they are being prosecuted. But if it wasn't for that video, that's why the district attorney, the county attorney, is the most important person, because if you had a fair county attorney, they would have seen that video and said, this is wrong, and these gentlemen would have been prosecuted, months ago.
I can't believe how long we didn't know about that without that piece of without that tape, that could have just happened quietly, been a very local, quiet story, and look what it kind of stirred up in our country. It's unbelievable. Now, how about in that case? Is that a civil rights case because the offenders were not government agency? Where does civil rights kind of coincide with that case?
I mean, you might have a case against the prosecutor who didn't prosecute because of that political affiliation.
Okay.
And that's the thing. When you have a conflict as an attorney, your job is to notify, the judge to notify authorities and say, I have a conflict here. I can't prosecute this case because this is my best friend. Right. I can't prosecute this case because this person has given me tons of money. Please get an independent prosecutor involved. The fact that it wasn't done, there could be some, you know, ramifications of civil rights as far as that. This is more like a hate crime right here. And and hate crimes are when people, you know, hurt another person or kill another person due to their race or sexual orientation. So those are different things that can fall under as a hate crime. So here, this can be prosecuted as a hate crime based on words that were used, based upon how they acted towards, you know, how they chased them, and they shot him. And they can prove that they shot him because he was African-American, and if he was raped, that can definitely be considered a hate crime, which could be an aggravating factor, and that could, you know, definitely send these guys to prison for life involved in this murder.
I'm so glad you brought up hate crime. That was one of my questions. So to distinguish a hate crime from a civil rights violation, so the hate crime part would be just citizen to citizen. This isn't coming from an agency, a government agency necessarily. It's just person to person with some specific factor that motivates the crime.
Exactly, yeah. In each state has their own, you know, hate crime law, or, you know, that they look into hate crime. Yeah, if you can prove that a person was hurt or harmed due to the fact of their race, that right there is considered a hate crime.
Wow. Okay. So there's just these terrible stories, and it feels like, you know, Rashard Brooks just happened Friday, and it was after the other three that we mentioned prior. It feels like they keep happening, but again, we're at this critical point. So in your opinion, from where you sit, you know, personally and also professionally, what do you think the way forward is? The big question, I know.
I mean, you have a lot of people upset and angry, and that's why the protests are continuing, and hopefully the protests keep continuing. I think after the protests are done, or even during the protests, we need to get into solution mode. And I think we are seeing some stuff that are happening. I think, you know, state legislatures and the federal government is hopefully trying to make real change, you know, not just, you know, lip service, but actual change. And like I mentioned before, change in police policies, change in police culture. I see some agencies throughout the nation are banning the chokehold,
yes,
meaning that, you know, unless there is, you know, unless the officer's life is in danger, they can't just use a chokehold. It used to be they can just grab you, use a chokehold. You might have just taken a candy bar, and you might die over a candy bar because the officer puts you in a chokehold. So, I mean, banning things like that, you know, body cameras, governmental immunity, just police training and educating the citizens and educating the police. So I think that's when you can get real, you know, civil rights reform, and hopefully you won't see these cases, more and more of these cases on the news.
How much of this can be applied federally, these changes? Because it seems like they're agency by agency or local to the state, but don't you think some things need to be federally mandated to make it an equal playing field across the United States?
Exactly. Yeah. No, I do believe. I mean, because if different states have different laws, it's not equal. But if the federal government can get involved and pass a federal law, which, you know, supersedes and oversees state law, then you have a law across the nation that goes to criminal justice reform. So, like, for example, the chokehold. If the chokehold is banned across the nation, that means no cop can't use a chokehold unless their life is in danger. Body cameras. If there is a law that has body cameras, every police agency needs to have a body camera. That would definitely change the system, the civil rights system, criminal justice system.
Right.
And that would be a big impact.
So how likely is that to happen?
That's the $1 million. That's $1 million question, right?
Yeah.
And hopefully, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, like I said, hopefully George Floyd's death, you know, Rebecca, is not in vain. And hopefully, you know, these are real changes coming. But I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful people are finally waking up. And that's why as long as the protests keep going, it will, you know, make people pay attention and things will change. But the way our news cycle works and our media works, unfortunately, you know, it could be popular this week and then 2 weeks later, they're often a different story, you know.
Right.
So hopefully, finally, people will make changes and people are on board. And no matter what political side you're on, I think this helps everybody.
I agree with you. Do you have any, before we wrap up, do you have any advice for people like me who are, you know, concerned citizens? We want to be part of positive change forward, but we're not necessarily working in the system. What can we do? What would you tell your community?
I would tell the community to email, call your state representative, call your city council person, call your mayor, call your governor, and let them know that you want real justice reform, because these are the people who have the power to change the law. And if you get your local government on, you know, on being able to look at these laws and being able to change it, that's the first step. So people need to understand politicians, their minds can swing easily. Mm. And if enough people are on a bandwagon and they believe, you know, change is needed, I don't care what your political affiliation is, they're going to change because they want to be reelected.
Right.
So I would tell people, write, email, call, and let your congressperson know that you want to see change. And not just say you want to see change, but say what change that you want. Do you want body cameras? Do you want governmental immunity to go away? Do you want a citizens review board where citizens can review police officers and make recommendations?
Yes, all of those things.
About discipline or not. Yeah, so I believe that if I had to leave with one thing and one most powerful thing, we are powerful. Sometimes we sit at home and we think that, okay, we can't do anything. No, you can pick up the phone right now and call. And your taxes go towards their salary. So don't be afraid to make that call and make that email, because your taxes are paying their salary and they represent you.
That's so good. Such good advice. Thank you. And a good reminder when it starts to feel overwhelming that there's actually things we can be doing and doing them continually. So that's really, really good insight. Thank you so much. Benjamin, one thing I ask...
No, Rebecca, thank you.
Oh, yeah. No, this was just so eye-opening for me. Before I let my guests go, I always ask them this one question. So I'm going to ask you, what is keeping you up at night right now?
What is keeping me up at night? So, you know, practicing civil rights, we're getting a lot of phone calls. You know, a lot of phone calls from, you know, people, various people and everything. And basically, what's keeping us up at night is just trying to, respond to everybody. Just trying to, you know, educate people. A lot of people in the community are definitely, you know, asking us for help, asking me to come speak at different events and different places. So I think just worrying about, you know, hopefully this is real change. I mean, people see George Floyd, people see Breonna Taylor, I think people see Ahmaud Arbery. People see, you know, all these cases going on, but we want to, you know, we want change. We want to be able to hopefully have change. So it's worrisome. And sometimes you can't watch the news all the time because it's sad. But, I mean, this is the time now to act. And what keeps keeping me up is just making sure that hopefully change is going to happen, and real change.
Real change, that is the hope. Benjamin, thank you so much for being on Dialogue, for sharing your expertise and your time. I know you have a lot on your calendar right now, so thank you so much.
No, thank you, Rebecca, for having me on the show, and let me know if you need anything. I would be happy to come back to educate and help your viewers understand anything about civil rights law, criminal defense, or personal injury. So we thank you for the time.